My name is Bill Martin, and I live in North Pekin, Illinois.
All right, and Martin is spelled?
M-A-R-T-I-N.
Okay. You were going to high school where, and when was this, and how did you transition into the service?
Well, I was, went to Woodruff High School, and I graduated in 65, and that December 13th, I joined the Army. And I went in from there, and I went down to, did my Fort Polk, Louisiana, and did my basic training in AIT down there at Fort Polk.
And your AIT was in?
I started out in infantry, and then after I got finished with that, I got into COMMO, well, kind of like a COMMO thing, but it was crypto. And I learned crypto down at Fort Polk. We had a real nice special little thing there all wrapped up in barbed wire where we went in to do our top secret crypto machines, mm-hmm. which by the time we got done and I got ready to ship to Vietnam, they had discontinued the machines. They were no longer of use for anything.
So no crypto for you?
No crypto. It was, you know, it was an old system, and they, I don't know why. You know, it was a secret type, real secret system. I don't even talk about much about it now because I don't even know if they want the word out on it, but it was funny machines.
So did you use anything from your AIT training?
Nothing whatsoever. I worked a little bit on as a lineman over there, but then, you know, you didn't stretch much wire over in Vietnam either.
So when did you ship out, and where did you end up in country?
Well, I shipped out from down there at Fort Irwin, California. We went down there and did some of our jungle training in the desert. And then from there, they shipped us out on a ship, USF Barrett, out of Oakland. And we went from there to Okinawa. We spent 24 hours at Okinawa, resupplying the troop ship. And then we shipped from there and went to Quy Nhon. And I hit in country in Quy Nhon.
And for those of the people who are watching that don't know where that is, where in country is that?
That's in just almost about in the middle of Vietnam somewhere, just maybe a little bit south of the halfway mark, I guess.
Do you recall how long it took to get over on a ship?
Over 30 days.
30 days?
Yeah,
to get?
32 days, if I remember right. We did through the whole ceremony of the Demon of the Deeps and all that, and the shellback crap. I got my little certificates, being initiated and everything.
Did you, this is jumping ahead for a moment, but did you fly back then when you were done with your tour?
When I come home, yeah. I flew out of Comrade Bay.
So you arrive in country, and you have an MOS, but you're not going to use it. So what happened?
Well, it was just circumstances, I guess, and my MOS would have started out working with because I was a communications in that, so I was working with artillery units, and we worked as FOs for them, basically, or spotters and stuff like that. And the unit I went over with, I hardly ever spent any time with them whatsoever, because everybody, all the FOs and that was kind of mixed up. You might go out under, you know, your unit, but you'd always use somebody else, you know, some other unit did most of your firing for you when you needed to fire. We didn't, you know, it's not, excuse me, it's not like bang, bang, shoot them up all the time, like a lot of people think, you know. It just, some days were boring. Some days you spend all day trying to hide, you know, and get to where you want to go and stuff like that.
Could you explain to us what an FO does and how you coordinated with, and this was with artillery units,
artillery,
right?
Units, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, when you went out, we were embedded with infantry units mostly when we went out, or small squads. It wasn't always big ones. And whenever we found the enemy or some infantry unit needed support, that's our job. I was with the lieutenant and an RTO and me. And our job was to call back to the artillery unit, which was in the rear, and send coordinates to them. And the coordinates we took off the map, and we'd give them the coordinates from the map, and they'd put it into their map, and they'd plot the map and turn it into other numbers, and they would give it to the send it to the guns with an azimuth and everything, and then they would set their guns, and they'd fire one round for a spotting round, which was a smoke round usually, well, it wasn't usually always, And then after that, then we just tell them, you know, fire for effect. And so, they just start dumping the iron on them.
So what did you do specifically? Did you have to go out into the a secure area, so to speak, and spot?
No, no secure area. We were with infantry. We were within sight of the enemy all the time.
So you stayed in a place where you hopefully would not be spotted.
Yeah, we would try to hide in the jungle. That's where we were at. You know, so we could get down. If they seen you, then you were in trouble because you wasn't going to be able to get your artillery in on time. And it did happen sometimes. You'd get spotted, and then you, because the first thing when they start hearing the rounds coming in, the first thing they start looking for is an FO. Because somebody had to be close enough to get the coordinates of where they were at. So then they'd start looking for us.
And so, you were spotted on occasion?
On occasion we were spotted, and we were doing some pretty good foot beating.
So you had binoculars, et cetera?
Oh, yeah, we had everything we needed. We had binoculars, we had ammo. But most of the time there was just three of us. Sometimes maybe before.
And then when you called in the smoke round and then you told them...
Smoke grip, yeah, that was the marking round.
Yeah, then little long, little short, whatever.
Right, and then you'd send them, you know, we had you'd send them an adjustment and either short so many or long so many, and then they would adjust on their maps, and I'd have my map. And then usually after one, no more than two adjustments, you're getting them. And sometimes you're lucky, you can really, for some reason, who knows? Sometimes we dumped our first rounds on them. And that's usually, you should usually shoot one gun unless you're really pressed. You fire one gun and that's your base gun. And that spots the first round. And from then you adjust over or under, left or right to bring it in. If you don't have time, then you just the whole battery fire for effect, which means you dump it all on.
Did you spend your entire time as an FO?
Yeah. But that doesn't mean I was in the jungle all the time, every day, day in, day out. And, you know, you'd be there. Sometimes I'd go days, we'd just be back at a base camp or we'd be, you know, bouncing around. I did quite a bit of highway security with convoys that would go up and down the highway from, like, Quinyan. That's where all the supplies come in. And then we'd have to, they would send them on up to the different other larger LZs and that they could convoy them into, and they always needed gun jeeps and that to protect them, and spent a lot of time when there wasn't a unit to go out with and be an FO, we worked with a gun jeep protecting the convoy.
And on these convoy trips, what exactly were you doing?
It was usually, we had our jeep, we had a lieutenant and me, and then my RTO, and either me or the RTO would be standing in the back with an M60 machine gun. And then the other one of us would be in the front seat with the LT with the rifle.
You were there for how long?
18 months.
And the normal tour of duty was 12 months. Why did you choose to do 18 months?
Don't know. I just, guys had been jumping into it, and so I went ahead and signed up to stay. And it also helped me that when that time was up, my enlistment was up. And I thought, after being over there, I wasn't going to put up with stateside. So I just went ahead and extended out. Actually, I went past my DROs. 4 days.
Is there a way of explaining, because when I came back, I still had time left. Mm-hmm. And my duty was right at the end of the war. I got out in December 72, and I didn't want to be stateside. I wanted to be over there, but the war was ending, so I didn't have an option. And they said, the war is winding down, you're a Vietnamese translator, we don't need you. So I was able to get out of the Army at that point in time. But is there a way of explaining to the general public why you don't want to come back stateside after having served in a war zone?
Back at that time, when we come back, I come back to Anchorage, and then from Anchorage to Fort Lewis, Washington. And when we landed, we come into the back door, and they bust us out with blacked out windows in the bus at night, because of Fort Lewis, Washington had all the protesters were still there, and they would beat on the bus and that and start with. So then they started running the buses out the back gates, with all the windows blacked out so that nobody could see who was in the buses, and that's how they got us out of there. But all the protesters were still there. And when I left, and when I got spent 2 days getting all my paperwork and my medical and all that together for my to be released to go home, and went to Fort Lewis, Washington, all I had to wear was, I had my greens, the new clothes they gave me. And we went to the airport, and you kind of had to just sit back and hide and stay away from everybody because protesters was all over the airports too. So then I flew into Chicago in the middle of the night, and O'Hare was closed, and I had to sleep in a chair and wait to fly out the next morning to get home.
You mentioned your medical papers. You were injured in Vietnam.
Yes.
Can you tell us how that happened?
A mortar round, we got hit. And a mortar round, I didn't realize it at first. I was up at LZ Tom, and I think we took 3 rounds. And I got hit, the CO got hit real bad. He took a head wound, which I found out years later that he survived it. And I took one in the leg, and a couple other guys, and Sergeant White, I think is what his name was, if I remember right. He took a hit, and it was all shrapnel, but they only sent one mortar in, and they got lucky, they got 3 people. Was it?
Wasn't that where you, on the base, you were hit?
That was at LZ, up there at LZ Tom, up north. That's where I worked at all the time, or not all the time, I spent a lot of time up there. It was an artillery fire base. We had to usually, the road up there, it was Highway 1, and it was always mostly blocked off. And before we could get a convoy or any vehicles up it, the engineers come in and swept the road looking for mines. We got lucky one day, and they found an 8-inch round laying there buried. And we followed a combo wire out, probably the length of a football field, come to the end of it. We thought we were going to find a detonator. But there was no detonator on it, which meant they weren't going to fire the round. Nobody knew we were coming, and we got by them. We pulled all the wire up. Engineers dug it out, and they come to the conclusion, as hard as the ground was, they had no clue how long it had been buried. And we thought maybe that the Viet Cong buried it and forgot it was there. But I don't know how many times they went up that road. You always had to sweep the road going up. And how many times they missed it, I don't know. It was scary.
You stop and think about that. Yes, your injury was to your leg.
Yes, the left leg.
And shrapnel injury, obviously.
Shrapnel.
Mm-hmm. You carried that parts of that shrapnel back to America.
For quite a while there, I used to set metal detectors off when I'd go in certain places where they had the metal detectors to go through. I'd have to sit there and take my shoe off and show them my leg that there was a scar there. Then they'd take that handheld wand and go over my leg, and it'd burp a little bit.
And you've had some surgeries.
Oh, yeah.
As a result of more than just the shrapnel.
More than just the shrapnel. I had I've lost half of my left lung. I had that taken out. I've had from a tumor. I had a tumor taken out of my left ear. I had a tumor removed from my larynx. And a tumor removed from the nose.
Was there any diagnosis?
The doctor, when he first started on it, when he found a thing in my lung, he passed away now. He passed away not long after I'd had my surgery. And he asked me about if I'd had a trip over to Southeast Asia. Because I come home, and I'd only been home like 6 years when all this stuff started popping up. And I told him that I'd been over in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam. And he flat told me, he says, I'm not going to talk about that. I'm not going to get involved in that mess. And he says, I can help you, but I won't discuss it. That's all he would say. And then, like I said, I tried to contact him a few times to see if I could get him, to say something, because I was thinking about then trying to get some maybe proof that that's what I had for disability from the government. And he wasn't going to get involved in it, and I don't blame him. But then later on, finally, after he'd passed away, he died from lung cancer himself. And then when it finally come down, then I thought, I was right. When they started checking people out and finally admitting that Agent Orange was more than what they thought it was.
And you're now on disability through the VA?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I've had more surgeries since then.
A total of?
No, I don't know, about 12.
A dozen.
You count all, yeah, but it probably does. And if you count some of the little bitty surgeries and stuff, you know, and some of them, I'm not saying they was all connected to my time in the service overseas. You know, but and I can't prove any of it. Well, yeah, it was proven a few years back there. It was a presumption that if you were in Vietnam and you had certain things, it was service connected, and that's where my service connection comes from.
Generally speaking, you consider yourself fortunate after your service in Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. I spent a lot of time drunk.
Was that self-medication?
Yeah, yeah.
And how'd you get by that?
A few years ago, I just quit. I was one of them guys that when I drink, I drink. If I started drinking at 5 o'clock, I was drinking at 5 o'clock the next day. My weekends would start on Friday. They would end on Sunday sometime. And I drank all through. Sometimes I drank 24 around the clock.
Yet you consider yourself fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
You had some friends who didn't make it back.
Correct.
How many?
Well, 8 or 9.
That didn't come back. And these are people that you knew personally. I mean, from high school.
Went to school with some of them.
Mm-hmm. When you look back, and this was 65, you went into the service?
Mm-hmm.
And you got out in...
68.
68. When you look back, are you proud of your service?
Yes.
You did the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so did the 58,000 plus that didn't come back. The reason I ask if you were proud is because you came back and you may not have talked a lot about it, but you certainly did something about recognizing veterans. Can you tell me a little bit about your service to your fellow Army members in the organizations you've been participating in?
Well, finally, after all the years, I'm a member of just about all of them. I was on the committee to build the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Springfield. When it first started, I remember when that was, 28 years ago, 29 years ago. I'm still affiliated with that. I'm still a committee member. I go down there every year. We do a full weekend vigil for the POWs, because we know they're not all home yet. We do that from a Friday to a Sunday. We have a Saturday ceremony. Then we close it down on Sunday. But we recognize a 24-hour vigil watch around the Vietnam Veterans Memorial down in Springfield. And we get guys from all over the state. Some of them have been there as long as I have, and some of them will come and they will be around for a few years and then, you know, you won't see them again. But it's means a lot to me because I was on the original committee. I was on the original fundraising that we did. I went around and did some fundraising for it.
How long did it take you to get that memorial put up?
5 years.
5 years?
Yeah.
Other organizations that you've been participating in, how else have you helped fellow veterans?
Well, I volunteered. For a long time there, I volunteered down to VA for a Medal of Honor recipient from Peoria here, Lieutenant Colonel Hal Fritz. I volunteered down there helping him out when he needed a hand and worked in his office and that. Served in the officers in the VFWs and that. I still to this day, if now and then somebody, a veteran needs something or needs a little help, I'll go help them out. All they got to do is let me know, you know, and be honest about it and not being, just trying to get something free. I don't mind helping somebody and give them something free, but freeloaders, I can't handle.
You, for many years, were on the executive board for what was called 92 Bravo. 90,
yes.
Can you explain what 92 Bravo was?
Well, we named it 92 Bravo because it started in 92. And I'm not sure if I don't even remember where the Bravo come from. I guess Bravo. It's just, you know. But, we put on a veterans ball for, 10 years? I think we got through it, didn't we?
I think it might have been
10, 11 years, 12, yeah, yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we put in a nice formal ball. You know, you didn't have to wear, you didn't have to be, you know, all gussied up. The girls loved it because they got to put, you know, new clean clothes and you know, all the good fancy stuff on. And we always brought a good speaker in from out of town, best we could find out usually. And then all the money we raise, we give it to the local ROTC units to help with scholarships for the kids that were in the ROTC. And we let them pick who their top cadet was, and that's who we gave the money to.
I want to talk a little bit about the photos. I don't want to, there are some photos of...
Oh, and me and my book?
You and your book. Can you tell us where those, I mean, where were most of these photos taken?
Well, they're all taken in up in the Central Highlands. And I spent all my time, I never did go down south. But the Central Highlands was close to, you know, at times you get real close to the DMZ. LZ Tom wasn't too far from the DMZ. But spent all my time in that area, you know, either back at a base camp somewhere where they had an artillery unit, spending a few days, or out a number of things, you know, travel the road.
We've been talking in acronyms here. Can you explain to people about... LZ, FO, RTO,
yeah. All right, and LZ is a landing zone, and you needed that because a lot of times, mostly where I was at, you couldn't get in there with the vehicle, so everything was choppered up. They'd bring all your equipment up, they'd bring you in, and FO is a forward observer, the guy that was out being snoopy and trying to find the enemy, and then you'd call them in, and the artillery unit set back at a fire base. It's called a fire base because that's where they're based at, and they're going to start firing from there. And I guess, would I miss it?
RTO?
Oh, an RTO, yeah. The RTO is what basically I was, a radio. They called it a radio telephone operator. That come from way back in the World War II time, and that when the radios weren't all that good a lot of times, and they really communicated with these field telephones. With telephone wire. Well, then, very few cases I ever saw that over NOM, except in a large LZ or something. They'd use it within the LZ, and then the artillery guys would use it within the fire communication center, and each gun had a telephone on it. And they'd use that telephone there, and it was just like a closed circuit phone.
We've talked about your service in Vietnam. We've talked about some of the veteran-related participation that you've had. What did you do when you got back to country?
Got drunk first day.
and we've discussed that, too.
I did that, and then I think it was 6 months later, I was married with a kid coming.
And then for employment?
Oh, employment? I had 90 days, I think it was, before I had to go back to Caterpillar, and I used every one of them, and then went back and worked at Caterpillar. I retired from Caterpillar with close to 37 years.
So had you worked at Caterpillar prior to going into...
I went in and got 30 days. At Caterpillar at the time, you worked 30 days, and you were in the union, and you had a job. And if you left to go to the service, your job was guaranteed. So basically, that's why I went and got into Caterpillar and got my 30 days in, so that if I survived Vietnam, I come home, I had a job, because they had to take me back.
And what did you do at Caterpillar?
I started, when I first come back, I just pushed a broom for quite a while. And then I got in with the millwrights, and I was a millwright.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you with regard to your service in country or your services after coming back that you'd like to share with us?
No, we about covered it all. Other than when I took me a while to, I spent a lot of time trying to get over anger. I still have a problem at times, but I don't drink anymore, and that helps.
What were you mad at?
I don't know. Sometimes it was me. Sometimes somebody could just do something, and here I am. Or if I seen somebody, like, now and then, I'd see people picking on some little guy or something, or drunk at a bar. So I spent a lot of time tending bar, and you know how the little's drunk in the bar, and he passes out or something, how everybody messes with him. Well, that made me mad. I don't know if it wasn't so much whether I was going to protect him or give me the opportunity to get a hold of somebody, just to get some of my anger out. You know, I can't really say. I wasn't an angel. I wasn't nobody's guardian angel. Just somebody can't defend himself. You don't mess with it.
Did some of that anger, I mean, do you know that that came from, at least in part, from your service in Vietnam?
I don't know. I never did blame it on that, but I went that way before I went.
Bill Martin, thank you so much for sharing with us.